This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling wars.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blowhard evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comments section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me at Bloated Nemesis on Twitter. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at @green_weird, which is W-Y-R-D. This episode, we muse on the post-9/11 world from multiple perspectives, then discuss Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's re-election troubles. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts.
Signed with a shake and a smirk. Centralized states can turn a blind eye. Those who benefit never ask why. Just sit back and enjoy some cocoa beans. They don't wonder what profit really means. Those indicates from the Iron Tower. Waste your life in a struggle for power.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to Tell Me What to Think. You are now entering Weak Thoughts. Make sure to check us out on our Facebook page, Tell Me What to Think, and our website that has all the old episodes, www.stoneduckmedia.com. On Facebook, I'm at Bloated Nemesis. I'm Peter. Charles is at @green_weird, and you can email the pod at tmwttpod@gmail.com. Charles, how are you doing?
I'm okay. The weather finally broke.
Well, it stopped raining, and then all the mosquitoes came out.
Yeah, well, you'll get that. All the standing water and the flooding.
My whole body is itched for about a week now.
Oof.
Yeah, it's bad. Although, despite the mosquitoes, I played one of my best disc golf rounds the other day at the beautiful Token Creek in Dane County.
Awesome.
And speaking of excellent sports performances, just right off the bat, I'm going to give a big, some big love to the Green Bay Packers, who had a, like,
amazing game.
Yeah, like, legendary comeback against the Bears.
Another one for the history books on Rodgers.
Came out of the locker room, yeah, from, what, 17 points down, I believe.
Yeah. My knee's up. Hold up. Wrap it up. Let's go. Put me back on the field. They just paid me a bunch of money, so I have to go prove that I'm worth it.
And actually, speaking of Rodgers, I don't know the background behind why this happened, but he got to pick a charitable donation that the Packers gave to a Wisconsin charity, and he gave it to Legal Action of Wisconsin, $50,000, which I believe is some sort of social justice.
Yeah, I saw that. You know what they do?
Not yet. Hopefully it's not a... I assumed because Mandela Barnes tweeted it out, it wasn't some sort of like front for conservatives or something. Let's see what they do.
Oh, it's legal representation for low income.
Great. Wonderful. That's very cool.
Yeah.
And I will also mention the Milwaukee Brewers are one game back, although they are, as we are recording, losing to the Cubs tonight, but they have won, like, three out of four of their last games against the Cubs they've won, and the Cubs are number one in the whole National League, much less their division. So Wisconsin sports are doing well.
So they were, like, four games behind. That's great news. Well, they were also a game ahead in the wild card hunt.
They are more than that ahead now.
Wow.
Yeah, they're like 2.5 ahead or something like that.
Wow, so playoffs are shoo-in.
Yeah, and actually there's two wild card teams. They are 2.5 above the second place wild card team, who is another game or two, whatever, above
So to actually get into the playoffs, they're like 3.5, 4.5, something like that. So yeah, they're doing really well.
All right. Well, now that we've covered our sporting segment,
Because it's kind of already old news. Like, I wrote this down as a topic after we recorded last week's episode, but then the anonymous op-ed came out, and the now famous New York Times anonymous op-ed. I think all the takes have been had. Did you have anything to say on it?
I still think it could be Zinke.
Really? He seems like...
I mean, why not? He fits, like, he's former military, he's old white conservative, he'd agree with, like, at least 49% of everything Trump does, if not closer to, like, 80%.
He seems like, I mean, he's a show, like, he does the showing up on the horse and wearing cowboy hats, and he's, like, kind of corrupt and...
Super corrupt, right?
I mean, I guess, you know, they all are, so...
You've covered that.
But... I don't know. He doesn't strike me as... I mean, you're the one who said that you thought it was probably a national security...
Somebody in the military, but, you know, not necessarily in the military now.
Yeah. But, I mean, like a Mattis type, like, former high level, right? That's what you're implying?
Officer in SEAL Team 6, so...
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I imagine there's some... fucking people wackier than Donald Trump who's been on SEAL Team 6, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, during the campaign season, there were pictures of SEAL Team 6 moving on public roads with flying literally the Trump flag.
Yeah. I mean...
But no,
I'm not even convinced Trump doesn't know about who did it. Like, doesn't, in reality, it wasn't run by him first.
So anyway, I'm not even convinced he didn't know about it. Pardon me? He didn't know about it because it's like, it kind of like promoted his agenda while like fear-mongering, but he's not afraid to fear-monger. It's like, he's not afraid to be crazy. Like, he knows that people think he's crazy.
Well, and I guess it's interesting that you point that out because like what, the one instance was like he was going to nuke a free trade agreement. I mean, sorry, I shouldn't use that term euphemistically in this, he was going to cancel a free trade agreement with South Korea.
Which, but that was also going to come out in the Woodward book, if I'm correct, or at least something very similar.
Exactly, so...
Which he knew about.
And his supporters would be like, yeah, that's my president.
Yeah, it's just the fact where the whole timing of it, it just doesn't convince me of anything good at all.
Yeah, it's interesting. It could be just be a political grounding rod, something to sink all the negative press coverage.
I think I was saying to someone a couple days ago about it, where it's like, the upside of it... Okay, here's the way I view it. This is the last thing I'll say about it, because I haven't really heard this take said anywhere else. So the downside is actually not that bad, because the people, his core, you know, which his much talked about, you know, core of support, his base.
Ever shrinking core.
Yeah, but slowly. I mean, barely, imperceptibly, it wavers, right? Yeah. None of them will be turned off by this. Like, none of them. No. There's not one person who's like wearing a MAGA hat and they're like, whoa, anonymous op-ed, oh my god. But what it might do is reassure the kind of like the tattered edges of the Republican coalition or the suburban soccer mom type, you know, that have kind of been talked about as like a swing between 2016 and potentially 2018. And the people who are like really freaking out because they see shit on Twitter and Facebook and they're freaking out. They're like, oh my god, he might actually end the world. Then they see the anonymous op-ed, which is like, hey, he's really actually terrible, but we're all here to make everything okay.
Right, and but at the same point, that they're also saying, hey, he's really terrible and doing the crazy shit that these supporters want him to do.
But there's no call to action. Like, if he was really that crazy, that anonymous op-ed should have had a call to action for something.
Yeah.
And it had none of that. It had no language like that. The only if you actually look at it like it's like almost like a class assignment, the rhetorical purpose of that was to reassure.
Hmm. Yeah, because there's no ask.
Yeah, there's none at all.
Interesting.
And it's all the crazy stuff, which I think there have actually been Washington like press reporters who said this, like, or White House press reporters, have said, like, there's nothing new in it. The person didn't reveal any information. So it's like this, and I'm not proposing it was written by, like, someone who's not a senior administration official, but it could have been written by, like, you or I as, like, a piece of fiction. Like,
fan fiction?
Yeah, like, there was no, at least, except for what you just pointed out earlier, but even that was about to come out in the Woodward book. I mean, there's no, like, proof that it's someone who has access and knows shit that no one else knows. And I think that's because I think it was run by, if not him.
Oh, God, it was Kushner.
Maybe. Yes, I agree. Oh, my God. That makes sense. All right, we solved that one. And I haven't heard anyone else propose Kushner. I like it. That's good. Or maybe Kushner and Ivanka.
Mattis.
Well, I was going to say Ivanka.
No.
But,
I can't. I'm not sure she can write coherently.
Well, she could have dictated to Kush. Or, you know, they both dictated, like, together. So, to the only thing less cheery than the United States White House drama, ISIS.
Right. It's fitting as we're recording this on 9/11 that we talk mm-hmm. about, you know, the consequences of the Iraq invasion, mm-hmm. ISIS, or Daesh. They are back with a vengeance, and they're regrouping in the Iraqi countryside.
And so, okay, I mean, so, like, the first thought I have as someone who doesn't get into the nitty gritty of Middle Eastern reporting is, well, I thought that they weren't holding any more cities.
Yeah, they kind of gave up on holding cities once they were defeated in Raqqa. They went to a more distributed mode of operations because they couldn't have, you know, the standing giant factories that literally made them like hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of rounds of ammunition and kept them supplied with everything that they needed except for basic materials, but, you know, they were running so much and running huge drug trades and illegal oil trades that they were making that money to buy what they needed.
And presumably they made enough money, and they, you know, they weren't spending it on infrastructure for their occupation force. They are now using that money.
Well, they were spending. Yeah, they were paying salaries for all the people, but now those people are no longer there. And now they're, as I said, just trying to, who is it? The PBS News arm. What was her name?
Oh, yeah, I don't know, but I know.
But yeah, this reporting is interesting because apparently in eastern Iraq, nowhere is safe from ISIS anymore.
And that's...
which is a huge kind of development, yeah. Considering a year ago they were like, hey, we won.
Is it Simona Fulton?
That sounds...
Simona mm-hmm. Fulton wrote, and I'm seeing here on PBS NewsHour page,
there's like a two-part segment that she...
This is at least something, political instability facilitates resurgence of Islamic State in Iraq.
Yep, that's it.
So, but I mean, they still would have had some people after they got kicked out of the cities. I mean, they didn't lose, like, all of their, obviously.
Yeah, they've been fighting a low-level guerrilla warfare, or guerrilla war out in the Syrian-Iraqi frontier, and have been regrouping.
Is this worse? And by worse, I mean the ratio of instability to potential... I'm not going to be able to phrase this concisely. Potential to stabilize, like to fix the problem from the Iraqi government's perspective. Is this, like, worse than before, or is it before was so bad that even as bad as this is?
In some ways, this is worse because it's harder to fight.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a lot of the descriptions of the attacks that, you know, that journalist was portraying, it sounded like, hey, that could have been, like, a bunch of guys who live, like, 5 kilometers up the road and just did this overnight and then just reassimilated back into their civilian life, like, seamlessly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would be a huge problem.
Hmm.
And combined with the ongoing instability in Iraq, which, you know, saw violence at the American embassy, the Green Zone in Baghdad, an American compound in Basra apparently saw some rioting, the Iranian embassy in Basra just reopened after getting burned out.
Yeah, I saw some, it was probably on PBS NewsHour, actually, over the weekend as well, like large-scale protests where they burned, like, an Iranian consulate or something?
Yeah. Their embassy in Basra.
Okay, that's... Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. So... Let's just kind of put a pin in that, as they say. And can you talk about Syria now? Because that sort of has... You know, both were together being destabilized and land taken over by ISIS just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In the wake of the Iraq War and then the Arab Spring. So what's going on in Syria right now?
The last of the militants through the various humanitarian quarters have been quartered in Idlib in the northwestern part of the country. I think, 2.5 million people are in the area now. Like, half of them are from other parts of Syria.
Okay.
And this is seen as the last real battle, and perhaps the bloodiest battle of the Syrian civil war.
Yeah, the last battles often have that fear associated with them.
Yeah. You have former and, I guess, current al-Qaeda militants, back people probably from ISIS, too.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the other colorful, like Ansar al-Islam and the other colorful terrorist groups that have proliferated in Syria in the last 7 years.
Based on what you know, okay, so like I was hearing a lot about, this has been like a hot topic on whatever pundit shit and all that. What I have trouble picturing is how these groups and these organizations, these, which probably range from what? Probably just small couple guys in a cell calling them something to paramilitary organizations with thousands even?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do they, like, all live together, not peacefully, but, like, they're not fighting each other right now, right?
I'm sure they're, I mean, tactically and strategically, probably not. They're probably consolidating what remains of their position, but there's a little bit of a disproportionate amount of resources because some of these groups are being supported, if not lavishly, by, shall we say, wealthy benefactors in the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, they don't necessarily need to have huge swaths of countryside to man checkpoints and illicit taxes out of the people that they, in areas that they control. They can just, you know, keep fighting their quote-unquote good fight.
Okay, so they're holing up places. I mean, why, maybe this is like too simple and stupid of a question, but why is it why is there such a fear of it being so bloody? Like, one reason I've heard is because they're such experienced fighters, but it seems like when you have, like, I don't know, like, all these jet planes and shit, like, why is it so hard?
I mean, they leveled, well, I mean, I guess they, but we, the American government and its coalition leveled Raqqa with notionally precise guided munitions, killed thousands of civilians.
And then there were still fighters there, though?
Well, yeah, and some of them surrendered, and let them retreat.
So are they like, consolidating in population centers, then?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and the Idlib countryside. Okay. But the problem with the Syrian and Russian airstrikes are not necessarily discriminate. Like, the Syrians are known for their barrel bomb techniques, which consist of literally pushing a barrel out the back of a helicopter and having it explode with probably a pressure sensor on the ground when it hits.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of see, like, in the rural areas, yeah, they might be able to hide, but once they're found, it seems like the more advanced militaries would do pretty well against them. But in population centers, even for as callous of a opposing force as the Syrian and Russian militaries are, how is he going to maintain power in 10 years?
He'll be fine, just like his father was after, what city was that he raised in 83? Is it Duma?
Well, it must not have been that much fun. That fine if having this problem.
Yeah, with the Syrian civil war, it was kind of like a mix of domestic and international events.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it started in Tunisia with that poor fruit vendor who burned himself alive because he couldn't make a living.
Yeah.
And that really resonated.
But, I mean, I would find it hard to believe, especially with wealthy Persian benefactors, there won't be more shit resonating in... Not, you know, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, as they say, but someday.
Oh, it's Hama, not Duma. Hama, but okay. The guy his father leveled. But, I mean, I don't know. That's why he's going to kill as many people as he possibly can, so that they won't be a problem. Which, I guess, is the lesson that he must have learned from Hafez al-Assad's crushing the previous rebellion in 1983. Don't let anybody out alive. And people in Syria are just now finding out about, previous extrajudicial executions. They're receiving death notices about people who were, killed and burned in various prisons throughout Syria.
And the United States has nothing to do with this.
I mean, we outsourced our torture to them in the Extraordinary Rendition Program.
No, no. I mean...
Oh,
right now. Like, in Idlib. We don't have forces there, right?
Yeah, no. We have forces stationed further to the east, but the Turkish government is trying to negotiate a political solution, at least a ceasefire to allow so that they don't have 2.5 million refugees suddenly crashing towards their border.
But even that, I mean, the Turks... I don't know. I mean, okay. This kind of ties in a little bit with this article that our legal expert Dave TMWTT'd this past week. Did you get a chance to read that about kind of like a reshaping of the world order? And it's called here. I have it here.
Are you sure?
That post-liberal international order world. Some core characteristics. Yep. Here we go. I got it for you. But where I'm going with this is that one of the things it brings up is, its main point is that it's like, hey, yeah, okay, we think Trump is destroying all these international institutions, yeah. And we think in general international institutions are pretty good, but, I mean, they're really old, so maybe they're not perfect. Let's look at some problems that they might be faced with. Or they are faced with now, or will be faced with. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because the first one is major power rivalry in a non-hegemonic world.
And this is the goddamn end of history all over again.
Well,
just because the fucking Cold War thinkers finally won their fucking war, and they'd spent their entire goddamn lives thinking about it, and couldn't imagine what the world would look like afterwards. Everybody in the entire IR field is... since has been like, this is unfounded. We have no idea what's going to happen. Of course there's going to be major power conflict. That's the history of the world. It's just going to continue. The United States is going to fall like every other empire before it.
Just to be clear, he's trying to say that line of thinking is short-sighted.
That's right.
Okay, just to be clear that... But yeah, that's essentially why he's bringing this up. He's like, okay, all these people were like, democracy, capitalism, end of story. And it's like, actually, there's a lot. Like, history, we're still moving on, right? Like, the world still goes forward, and some people might have different ideas about things. And which he gets to a little bit later, where he's like, hey, I'm, you know, like, I like democracy and all, but, you know, like, point to a thriving, like, major power democracy right now. And it's like, you know, there aren't any that are having, like, all-star seasons. And he's like, you know, and he's like, maybe we need to recognize, he's like, doesn't mean it's good, but how there's, like, some countries in the world where those people are in such dire straits that they just want a competent government. They don't give a shit how it's formed. But that's not why I'm bringing this up. We can get to that in a second. It's just that he talks about so the non-hegemonic world is the important part there, where it's that even if America, or, you know, is the main power, or there's other, like, China is kind of, like, you know, up there as well, but a lot of these countries, like, he had, it's kind of like the second to last paragraph there, in that section, where he goes over all these instances of, like he actually says here, quote, I saw this while on the State Department policy planning staff in 2009-11, when so many of the, quote, asks prepared for high-level meetings with Pakistan, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and other U.S. allies and partners came back without compliance. Because, like, even the allies don't always
cooperate. You
know, yeah, they're not like, you know, it's not like a feudal kingdom, and they're like a supplicant king here.
Yeah, it's not like the emperor. It's not like the special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom.
But even that, I mean,
even that has limitations, yeah, as we're going to come to find out.
On both sides. I mean, both sides kind of have issues with the other, you know.
No taxation without representation. Oh, wait, we got past that.
Yeah, that was a big one. but, and actually, I found it interesting, too. It also brought up here, China, quote, China also is running into limits on its leverage with pushback against the Belt and Road Initiative in Southeast Asia and Africa. Real. As well as the costs and burdens of such commitments piling up on Beijing's budget and economy more generally.
Yeah, like two major Asian countries in the last few weeks have said that they're going to, if not, you know, entirely suspend, then, or if not entirely cancel, at least suspend their major Belt and Road initiatives. Like Malaysia's new prime minister is just canceling all of them outright. And Pakistan, Imran Khan, the new prime minister, has promised that they're going to be suspended for a year pending evaluation, and then one by one either continued or canceled. So China's facing some real pushback from the, shall we say, the tone of their agreements that they've struck.
And so this is all a roundabout way of, so when we talk about Idlib and how, like when I said to you, well, what does America have at all? Like, it, like, how can they be involved in that? Like, because, I don't know, like, call me old-fashioned, but, like I want to think of America at least sometimes being like, hey, human, like, we're not involved in your war, but there's terrible shit going on. Can we get some, like, aid in there or something? Like, some small part of the government is getting involved in some way. But we don't, like, necessarily have that leverage. Even in the best of alliances, if we had with Turkey, which we don't, because these two idiots are running their mouths off at each other all the time.
Yeah, we both are just terribly, or genuinely terrible at governance,
and,
in their own different ways.
Yeah, and so, like, and we obviously aren't, you know, cozy with Assad. Russia, whole other story, but Russia's not going to exactly let our people do shit to help anyone.
Their little arms show is over. They want to be done with this and go home.
Well, that's actually the last line of this paragraph too. They may well be on the verge of finding Syria more of an Afghanistan type burden than an opportunity.
Yep.
Since we're on the question, I just want to bring up the other ones of these, get your quick thoughts. This one I thought was interesting. State stability, and he calls it the Vegas dilemma, which is, and he actually uses, I believe, Syria as an example here as well, but it's, like what stays in Vegas or what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, where there's kind of like a sovereignty, like that's their issues. But then like all of these problems always, you know.
Except we're living in the 21st century where transportation and communications infrastructure allow us to like basically see these barrel bombs almost streamed live. So, yeah, there is no such thing as what stays in Vegas or what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and certainly not in Syria.
Broadly speaking, how do you think that type of... I mean, you could maybe make it specific about Syria, but you don't have to. It could be another refugee situation, maybe Myanmar. But just...
How does that unwind?
Well, like, how do you think the world order should... The international community should handle it?
We have mechanisms. The International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, are perfectly able and... You know, perhaps not as well funded as they should be, or well as well supported, John Bolton. But you know, they are capable of resolving these if countries aren't going to do it themselves. And it's ironic that the National Security Advisor should be so forcefully condemning the International Criminal Court when, again, they could bring Assad and his cronies up on charges. Like, let's put the Air Force or the general in charge of the Syrian Air Force intelligence on trial for all the extrajudicial executions and torture that he was responsible for. And Assad himself, I'm sure. There's criminal cases to be made here, but because all we have is hammers and no pens, there's no mechanism to resolve it.
Yep, that's a good, let's talk about the 9/11, post-9/11 world. What are your thoughts on where we are today?
Well, we're still at war. We're further along in a generational war that Cheney envisioned. Mm-hmm. Remember him saying, oh, we'll be at war for 20, 25 years or more. And that's apparently coming true. I didn't think he was right. I thought that was insane. Like, even Vietnam was shorter. But we needed, apparently, a war hawk like Nixon and Kissinger to finish this. But this is exactly, on the other hand, the quote from Osama bin Laden in 2004, and all the other times he's been interviewed, this is exactly what he wanted. He wanted a generational fight so that America would exhaust itself and leave itself lying bleeding and near dead on the ground.
It's interesting that they both wanted the same thing.
Yep.
So
where does that leave us now?
I mean, are we? Like, how much is it working against us? Like, a lot of times we talk about the war on terror, and, well, how well is it working at stopping terrorism? Well, let's look at it from, like, Osama bin Laden's perspective. Like, if you were...
A+.
You think A+? Really? I think that's... It's been, well, I mean, it's 17 years? I think if you would have told him for 17 years... Well, I guess the Iraq War started in, what, 2004?
Three.
So, 15 years for that, specifically. But I think if you would have told him U.S. will be involved in two wars for 15 to 17 years... And they will not be, like, crumbling, like, actually, you know, like the Soviet Union. As bad as we are right now, we're not, our democracy,
okay,
our government isn't, like, you know, that bad.
Yeah, it's not the Soviet Union in 91, but our social safety net is fraying at the edges.
Yeah.
Our defense portion of our discretionary budget and servicing the debt that we've garnered from, you know, swiping the credit card for Iraq and every other foreign intervention is coming to bite us in the ass.
Yeah.
We don't have the money to address climate change, which is going to keep killing people. We don't have the money to, I don't know, apparently rebuild Puerto Rico, where more people died there than on 9/11.
Your list of, and I'm sure this list could go on, right?
I can keep going.
On one, it's kind of like a double two sides of a coin, because it's like, on one hand, it's like, oh my God, there's so many terrible things. And on the other hand, it's kind of surprising we're holding up, like, despite all this shit. But it also makes you think, you know, at any moment.
Well, and to add to this point, like, a whole other level, like, the Vegas shooter and Parkland every other mass shooting that's been done with M4s and high-powered military rifles are because we're making so many of those to support the war on terror. And that is literally killing us.
Yep.
So yeah, the war on terror has been a complete and total fucking failure, except for the people profiting on it.
And the terror war. Yeah, I don't know. I think A+ is a little too much, but I don't know. It's passing. It's up there.
Osama bin Laden got literally everything he wanted from this. And now it's to the point where we've elected a person who's going to kick us out of our, you know, rightful leadership spot in the international order because we have no moral standing and apparently we have no resources to seek even friendly deals with nations and people that should, you know, look to America as that shining example on the hill that we always want ourselves to be. Like, even from the asshole capitalist perspective, I was thinking about this today. It makes absolutely no fucking sense to bomb the fuck out of all of these other fucking countries because you're just killing potential customers. It's like, those people aren't going to buy any of your t-shirts or power generation equipment or solar panels or anything now. They're just dead.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like this is some sort of, short-term conflict, which could lead to, like, a Marshall Plan, like, rebuilding of whole swaths of the world. We only do that for white people.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent that money in Afghanistan, and it's just gone, and Afghanistan isn't better for it.
Yeah, instead of having a war and then a Marshall Plan, we're just like, why don't we just keep spending that money on more war?
Genius. And apparently the according to the score card on that war, the Taliban has presence in like 60% of the country, controls 40% of the districts.
What a joke that war is. I mean, I've kind of heard this as like sort of a roundabout compliment of Trump, but he doesn't really like go the full distance to actually make this something where he's doing good, but he kind of mentions every now and then how skeptical he is of the Afghan war, and he kind of during the campaign hinted about being skeptical about other things overseas, but also talked about bombing families, you know, of terrorists, and so mixed messages. But but like, what? Why has the federal government articulated why we are still in Afghanistan? Like, in years? National
security. That's the classification and...
articulately... What's the word there? What's the adverb? Like, articulated it, like, well.
No.
Like, with details and nuance.
Can you imagine asking Trump, like, sitting Trump down for...
Well, he doesn't
know. Not even an antagonistic interview. Like, why are we still... Or even Cheney. Let's fucking... Find whatever coffin he's in and prop him up long enough to ask him that. Like, what are we still doing in Afghanistan?
Well, you know who I'd ask, actually? Mattis.
Mattis. Ooh, that'd be interesting.
Because I want to know why the people who are in a position now to do something about it... The only thing I'm getting through the filters of the media that I consume is pride. Like, it's the military community saying, just give us more and we can do it. We can do it. They just don't want to leave without total victory. But, like, what does that mean?
Well, it's a military budget thing. Like, they have to spend it all or else they won't get that much in the next year.
Yeah, but even that, you know, they're getting more than they're asking for. Like, greed only explains so much. From the government employee's perspective, yeah. Not talking about like why there might be a corporate lobbying effort. But like I just – the greed doesn't – it almost feels like no one wants to answer that question with any sense of urgency.
Mm-mm.
And it's such a weird thing to be complacent about, a war. Yeah, or like to be comfortable in.
The Taliban now has a red force of like specially troops that are basically special forces with night vision goggles and modern equipment.
That is astounding. They've been at this in their country for 17 decades. Years. I mean, just with America, but before that too. Yeah.
Oof. We can't win. What does winning even look like, as you point out? Why are we still there? Can anybody tell us? And the answer is no. So we probably shouldn't be there, to my mind.
Okay. Do you have a grasp on why if... So I know there's always bullshit with sitting down with enemies, right? So let's just set aside the bullshit, right? The only good thing about the Trump-North Korea stuff is that he set aside the bullshit. He just brought his own bullshit then, but... you know, and didn't really get anything done. But, like, so let's set aside that bullshit. Fake world. We're going to sit down with the Taliban and be like, all right, the only thing we want is to have some sort of international monitoring to make sure there aren't training camps for people that are going to come and bomb us here. Like, I understand you don't like us, but we will leave now. And throw $50 billion at you or something. I don't know.
Helicopter Ben.
We'll buy all your opium or something. I don't know. We'll make it worth your while so that you guys can do whatever kind of crazy government you want to set up if there aren't going to be people coming from Afghanistan who are trained here and protected here and killing us in America. What's... Is it just then pride on their side why they wouldn't have that? Or, there's kind of a sovereignty issue, but...
I'm not even sure they're the bad actors in these negotiations anymore. I mean, they even before 9/11, they were perfectly willing to give Osama bin Laden up to whoever would take him.
Yeah.
So...
No, and actually...
After like so many years of successive negotiations, the Taliban's leadership hasn't really changed as... much as the Afghani national government, so kind of have to wonder where the problems are.
That's kind of where I was leading, though, is I don't know why they wouldn't take that deal. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't really logically make sense. Ironing out some details here or there, and the fact that, like, I only heard whispers of there ever in all of Obama's tenure... whispers of like maybe peace talks, like they reached out here and there, but like nothing as far as I know was substantive
they like opened a Taliban office in was that Qatar? I think it was Qatar, now that I think about it. Like they were gonna sit down in Qatar and negotiate, you know, and that kind of has led to some peace talks, but again they didn't go anywhere and we're back to where we are now.
Is it a true statement that there are other actors there? Like, aren't there like
Well, there's like ISIS elements, other militias, other warlords.
Okay, well, yeah, but like, so, like there's like cells of
Taliban.
things like ISIS, though, right?
Yeah,
and so they're causing trouble, but the Taliban doesn't support that trouble.
No, I would assume not. Again, they're not necessarily the bad actors.
Yeah. Okay. You know, the thing I'll say about Afghanistan is that it feels like there could be a relatively sunny day at the end here. Iraq, I don't feel that way about.
No. I mean, the people in Basra have every right to complain. Like 100% of their water is chemically polluted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Hmm.
Because of nepotism, corruption, mismanagement, like, the parties handing out jobs in the ministries, and Iran's influence, and, yeah. The infrastructure that, you know, previously to the Iraq War had allowed Basra to have, like, virtually unlimited amounts of clean, fresh water because they're sitting at the bottom of a swamp, or, you know, at the Tigris and Euphrates, and mm-hmm. now they have no running water and barely any electricity. So, yeah, that's going to lead to instability, and we have to own it because we, in no small part, are somewhat responsible for it.
Yeah, Iraq doesn't feel like the situation where America can, like, just walk away, turn their back. But at the same time, if they're constantly dealing fucking ISIS there, I don't know. Or, you know, whatever kind of influence Iran has, and then their own conflicted, shady interests, you know, on our end. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a mess.
All right. So let's just end. We're kind of touching on some things. You had caught the eye of this. It was on the Intelligence Matters podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And, or I should say, your eye was caught, but I don't know. I hate turns of phrases. Yeah. They interviewed, so I want to get it exactly.
William of Evanina?
Okay. And he is with...
Michael Morrell.
Well, Michael Morrell, who's the former acting director of the CIA, it hosts the show. And, well, come on, they don't have his... Shit. So I just want to know the position that this guy holds. He's essentially the top counterintelligence person for the U.S. government.
Yeah. Is he FBI? I'm trying to remember.
Well, he used to be FBI. The way he described his... He's like on like a task force. And the way he described his job is that his job is to give recommendations to the CIA or the FBI. Maybe elements of whatever, you know, there's like 17 intelligence agencies.
Right.
Any of them that have any counterintelligence aspects to them, task force kind of like tells them the goals, but not how to get there. So there's more of a strategic element to it, but it is focused on counterintelligence.
Right, and the first thing that stood out to me, you know, I guess I didn't realize we were about to do a 9/11 episode, but it's just the general disposition of our Department of Defense since, you mm-hmm. know, that fateful day.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is entirely focused on China. I think it's wrong-headed in this the way that he's thinking about a lot of these threats, but, you know, he doesn't see the world as apparently the... You know, former president and vice president did in starting this huge war on terror.
Yeah, but don't you think that's the nature of his job?
Yeah. And the real... okay, and speaking of the China thing, the one quote that he said that really irked me was that they have significant students, or they're talking about China, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both China answer or the question. So the Chinese, two questions. Who brings more resources to it, and who brings more sophistication to it? And is any of that starting to change? William Evanina, both China answers. They bring ungodly resources that we can't handle right now because they have, for instance, just in the student population, there's 350,000 students that come to the U.S. every year to study. Majority of those are legitimate, but a lot of them aren't, right? And that was the first time that I put this down. Because that really, really irks me.
Go on. Like, why?
Okay, so statistically, no more than 100 or so of these students are going to be even active Chinese agents, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now, the 350,000 people, more people than live in Madison, right?
Mm-hmm.
are now going to have aspersions immediately cast upon them from being from mainland China. their best and their brightest who are coming here to find the best education that they can are going to be automatically turned off because everyone is going to be suspicious and hostile towards them.
Yep.
And that really, really pisses me off. That is not, that seems like the opposite of counterintelligence because you just created 350,000 people that you know have to fucking interview because you may or may not have actually pissed them off.
Yeah, well, he's just trying to create more work for his. Well, and speaking of, his group is, he is the director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. Just to get that on the record. I see what you're saying. And so what I kind of find interesting is that he described his job, the other thing he described his job as, he didn't really directly say that his, because I found it interesting. Because I had said on Twitter when this was brought up that Michael Morell rarely interviews current serving U.S. officials except for, like, elected representatives, you know, who always want to talk to the public, right? Put a mic in front of them. But, you know, he doesn't usually talk to, like, serving intelligence officials. So I found it highly unusual that this guy was on there. And though he didn't say his job is to talk about these things to the public specifically, he did say his job is to kind of like be a sort of like liaison to like private institutions, different parts of the government, you know, companies, businesses, whatever. And so like there is an element of him being kind of a public face to this and his words being the public face. And I found it weird that he was saying things like what you're saying. Like, it's one thing, I think you're kind of in a roundabout way saying this, like, okay, maybe it's one thing to have some reasonable caution, but then to publicly say it, like you're saying, cast aspersions on, is kind of just dumb.
Yeah, it just seems stupid. Yeah. Yeah, I guess we're saying the same thing in that respect.
Yeah. And so I don't really know why he did the show. I mean, I get why. I kind of even get why Morell would have him on. I get why. Because it's Intelligence Matters is run by CBS News. I mean, a news outfit is always going to want, you know, any quotable material they can get, good or bad or whatever, stupid or smart. But I don't really get what he gets out of it. From going on the show, except for kind of like informing the public, but he didn't really get into like that much.
This isn't like he's
so what is which is
once and sidelong asking, like, hey, we need to spend more time on China and Cuba, apparently.
Okay.
But
he didn't, not that much Cuba.
No, he talked about Cuba.
He did, but I mean, I listened to it. I mean, he was asked specifically, what are your big countries in terms of intelligence threats, however they may come? His number one is China, as you're saying, although his main reason for that is because they are more sophisticated than anyone else. They are bigger than anyone else, both in, you know, in everything, really. Yeah. And they are... they are concerned with economic things. He talked a lot about economic concerns, actually. Not really like, oh, they're a different kind of system, but like that they do economic theft, like of IP and whatever else.
Yeah, they've been known to grab whatever technology they can get.
And but then anyway, so then he says Russia, which you can't, you know, not bring up because it's in the news, right? And kind of says what you'd expect about that. They're reckless, they're more tactical than strategic, things like that.
And they're very, very, very sophisticated in their capabilities, like probably way more than any other state actors. The Russians in the cyber front, they proved how adept they are in several instances.
Well, the cyber front, I think, I think when he says, though, it's like you can catch them a lot, or like you know they were there a lot, but then also with like human intelligence, I guess they are, they're not as, they don't
they're not as sophisticated as the Chinese, was what he was saying. I don't know if it's true. Because I've also heard, like, other people, actually probably on this podcast, be like, dude, the Russians, man, they're the experts at this spy shit.
Yeah, they've printed your whole libraries of books on it.
Yeah, like, it's like... Like, for as much as they're not... And I think his thing is, like... I think that's what this guy's saying, though, about Russia is, like... I think he's thinking a little strategically. He's like, okay, Russia, yeah, they do a lot of damage. It sucks. But they're not going to all of a sudden, like, do significant... Not even do significant damage, but do so much damage to us that, like, they're now the number one world power or something. Is his thought. Yeah, because they don't have a huge economy, all of this. And but anyways, then he moved on to Iran, North Korea, and his last thing was Cuba. But he actually said, like, Cuba was mostly because they have ties to Russia and China.
And, yeah, that kind of irks me, too. Like, let's open up. They should be your biggest natural ally.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's not his job, but, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, that's how Cuba, it's, like, foolish.
To my mind, that's how you would, you know, set up a counterintelligence operation. Like, hey, get friendly with the local officials so that they're more willing to help you, like, you know, snoop through other people's cell phones and things like that.
No, that's true. I've been thinking this for a while, for, like, well, probably a year now. It seems like, despite Trump being a jerk about Cuba... Yeah, like he gave that speech early on in his presidency. He's like, we are not doing any of the shit Obama wanted to do, but it's like we are still doing some of it. Those deaths down there seem to have halted friendlier relations.
Deaths? What?
The diplomatic deaths.
Oh, the hearing.
Yeah, the weird hearing shit.
Yeah. I don't think anybody actually died behind that, but...
Oh, really? I thought someone died. Oh, maybe not. Maybe not. I could be wrong. Anyways, people were hurt.
Yeah.
And they had, like, weird shit going on. And it's, I think, scared some people. And there's, like, it's, like, a fucking X-Files episode. Because, like, the government is, like, hush-hush about it.
Yeah.
Or they just legitimately don't know. Which is almost scarier.
It's probably closer to the truth. But I think what happened there is that diplomacy kind of stopped at a certain point. So everything just, because nothing was moving, everything stopped moving, you know?
Well, no, I know, like, Trump coming in definitely was going to, like, slow down the process.
Well, and they've had a huge leadership change in Cuba, right? They had a new constitution and president just come into office.
Yeah, but are they against relations with the U.S.?
That guy was not as necessarily as friendly as Fidel might have been, for instance, but
But, I mean, it just seems like, for what little diplomatic activity there was, for then diplomats, who knows how it happened, but for them to be attacked in some way, shape, or weird fucking form, would seem to, like, halt what little there was. Like, maybe it could have kept going at a trickle, but unfortunately not.
That kind of, you know, points to the many allusions that it was some kind of intelligence job, because, you know, who stands to benefit from strained relations? The Russians and the Chinese and everybody who wants to keep the Cubans and the Americans from cooperating more closely. I want that vaccine for lung cancer, damn it.
They don't really have one, do they?
Yeah.
That can't be real.
Their medicine is, like, their medicine is incredibly advanced. Fidel spared no expense in building up that infrastructure.
But that's, like, a legitimate thing? That's not, like, a...
Like, it said, they have a disproportionate number of doctors in their population.
Oh, no, I have heard, I mean, I've heard all that for years. Because, you know, they definitely have taken the time to educate as best they could. All right. So, we are, let's just zoom in a little bit further on us first.
and talk about the one of the big national stories of the past couple weeks. We have talked about Kavanaugh kind of on his merits before. Although last time we recorded an episode, the hearings were still going on. In those hearings, there was kind of like definitely some hubbub about him lying under oath, being a political hack for years. My big thing about Kavanaugh from those hearings, from actually like listening to them for like hours on C-SPAN radio as I was driving around, was how often he brought up his, I've called it one of the four greatest Supreme Court decisions. And so someone's like, so do you agree with it? And he's like, well, I've called it one of the four greatest Supreme Court decisions, Senator. Okay, but do you agree with it? Do you agree with the decision? And he wouldn't just say yes. Like, he would say, well, I think if I call it one of the greatest, that means I agree with it. Okay, so can you say you agree with it? Well, I've called it one of the four greatest Supreme Court just. Oh, my God.
Man, is that what filibustering sounds like?
Oh, dude, he is. He's not, like, he's not charming or likable, or which aren't grounds for, like, in and of itself for not being a Supreme Court justice. But he's just not. I didn't think he was good on the stand. I mean, he didn't, like, drool and, like, call Kamala Harris the B word or something, but he was.
I mean, I don't know what she has on him, but he, it seems like she made him sweat.
Yeah, she went after him hard. I'll say this about Kamala too. Listening to her, I didn't realize it was her because I've never really heard her in a hearing before. Like I've heard her kind of like in interviews, but in the hearing, she talks fast, and I like it.
Well, because she's a prosecutor. She knows exactly how to, you know, speak quickly so that you can wear people down, make them jump to conclusions or say things that they don't necessarily want to, right, Pete?
Well, as a defense attorney, I find fast talking to be... yeah, maybe that's why. I mean, I don't know. Whatever it is. As a politician is what I'm saying. I like it. It's refreshing. It feels young. It feels fresh. It feels like she knows what she's saying. And she believes what she's saying because she's not pausing to think about it so much. Like, I do a lot, actually. But man, I don't know. I just really, like, I just enjoyed, like, her talking. I don't know how else, like, it's... I would like to see a longer speech of hers, actually. I don't think I've ever seen one. To see how she is at speeches. But anyway, yeah, she pressed him on whether he had spoken to anyone about
the Mueller investigation.
Yep, the Mueller investigation with the law firm that's like it's like a guy from there who's like representing some of the people from the White House or whatever. And it never really came of it. I don't know if there's more to come. It seems
she
like
was
she
just
was
laying grounds for potential perjury.
Yeah, but I mean. Hopefully she has something to back it up.
That guy has so many other potential counts of perjury, so whatever.
Oh, no.
He shouldn't be approved, but he's going to be, and that's terrible.
You know, I was thinking about that today, and I mean, safe money still definitely on him being approved, confirmed, but... Man, if something came out about the lying that was... flashier and easier to understand. And I know you're going to say, what's easier to understand than saying you didn't know that emails labeled spying were stolen? I'm just going to let that one hang out there then.
I was going to point to the Clinton stuff. Talk about hypocrisy.
Isn't this a case of Mr. Burns, though? Mr. Burns' immune system?
Kind of.
Isn't there kind of just too much?
He's just so fucked up, and, like, all the stuff from the Bush administration, like, all any of that stuff should have been...
apparently they haven't...
If you were involved in torture, well, we're not going to release those documents. We can't possibly know if you were involved in the terrorist surveillance program. We're not going to release that either. So,
does he know which documents get released?
Does he get to see them?
I assume not. I assume that they're just kind of going over them on his behalf.
I would assume at least not the... I mean, because theoretically they're all... had his name on it, so... But I don't know, if you're a former White House employee, you can't just... Can you go to, like, the National Archives and be like, dude, I'm the one who wrote it?
Yeah, the National Archives are the presidential libraries.
But for the stuff that's not public...
Yeah, nice. I mean, if you have the right clearance for it.
But he probably hasn't spent the past couple months going through 10 million documents. Anyways, the reason I bring it up is because just like the idea of, like, did he know some of these question lines of questioning were coming up, at least based on his documents, not the stuff based on wherever else Kamala Harris is getting that from.
Right.
I don't know. Like, was he surprised when someone was like, what about the email that says spying on it? I don't know.
Well, considering the intelligence community has a history of spying on the Senate, he might not have been surprised at the questions.
Well, he wasn't there at that time, though. Well, I guess he wasn't part of the intelligence community doing it. He was the White House spying on the Senate, right?
No, it was the CIA under
John. No, I know that's what you're referring to, but with the emails that had said spying, which were about Supreme or at least judicial nominations, were taken by a mole within one of the Democratic senators' offices and given to the White House. Is the way I understand that.
Yeah, so that should just categorize. But I guess I didn't appreciate the context of those emails that you were talking about.
Yeah, no one's claiming. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he knew, had prior knowledge. But no one's claiming he has had prior knowledge of it, like he set it up. But he read them and used them. He didn't like give them back and was like, "Oh, we found these." I mean, I might have read a couple pages, but here they are back. Like, they used them and read them and laughed about them.
Huh.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
That should disqualify him, right?
You'd think. Okay, so now let's fly into Wisconsin as if we're Scott Walker on a state-funded jet that we liberally use.
State Patrol's pilots are the one that fly him. What is he doing in Omaha today, I wonder?
Yeah.
Has he tweeted on anything today?
Yes, he tweeted. Well, according to that one report, he was going to visit, their governor or something like that?
Yeah, one of his former financial backers.
So the thing about that I didn't understand was that a current serving governor?
I think so.
Can you... I had that tweet up. I think I might have it up. Do I? Because...
Pete Ricketts, yeah, he's the current governor.
So can politicians... Well, though he might not have been in 2015 when he gave that money.
Yeah, he took office in 2015. But yeah, I can't imagine there's any rule on private or governors giving out their private money to politicians, right? As long as you're transparent about it and, you know, he just gives the money to the right PAC, I guess.
It seems
corrupt.
But I guess it's not more corrupt than, you know, non-government officials or elected representatives doing that. Like, that's... I guess they're just all corrupt, is what I'm saying. But it feels like because he holds an elected office, there should be, like, rules about how he spends his private money. But I guess, you know, there shouldn't be. Worse or like harsher rules for them.
There's some event in Nebraska, the Midwest and Japan 50th something. There's a whole line of them with Governor Ricketts and Governor Jeff Cloyer from Kansas, Rauner from Michigan or Illinois rather, and Scott Walker with Japanese counterparts. I'm not really sure what I'm looking at here. Yeah, there was an event, so I guess there was an official event for him to go to.
Yeah, in the Omaha World Herald, They have a story, Wisconsin's Walker tries to alter conversation amid bad news, but I actually recognize this AP reporter, and he's from Wisconsin.
Okay, is it Scott or Scott Bauer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Wait, you gotta see this. Ba-ba-ba. This is great podcasting stuff, I know, but look at the girl in this picture. So if you go, folks at home.
Holy cow, what?
She is, like, upset, disappointed, annoyed.
That's the most deadpan look I've ever seen. She doesn't look like she has any particularly strong feelings about anything that's happening in front of her.
Frankly, the other two guys in the background looking at Scott Walker don't look too impressed either. This is not your normal, like, ooh, lapdog standing behind, you know, the guy who's getting his photo taken, the famous guy. There are young people who look upset behind Scott Walker.
That stage manager just kind of looks annoyed. Like, is this guy still talking?
He's like, he's like doing this interview, and there's like, they're trying to do something. I think that's what's going on.
I think that woman in the background is trying not to be seen in the same picture as him.
Yeah. Oh, I can't blame her. You know, who does she think she is? Maria Butina? Ooh, anyways, wow. So I said the name. It's Omaha World Herald. Check out the picture. It's funny. He's been flying around a lot. He's spending a bunch of money to fly the state jet to Nebraska.
Like, more than Cuomo, right? Like, there's a huge thing about Cuomo taking public transportation, basically. And Scott Walker is, like, way worse. Way, way worse. Like, magnitudes of order more than governors in large states use their planes.
Yeah, no, and there was something like, it was, like, a bigger state he used it. Like, I don't know if it was, like, Brown in California or someone like that.
Well, Brown in California flies commercial except for an emergency, and Cuomo, is the one that had hundreds of flights in New York, but hell, even the guy in Texas flies commercial or on his own private dime for state business.
Yeah.
So,
You know, it kind of really comes back to roads. I mean, we've been harping on it for weeks here, but it's like just the roads and him, just not, they don't go well together. Alright, there was something about Evers and Walker, Tony Evers, who's the Democratic nominee for governor against Scott Walker. What was that that you wanted?
Oh, the PolitiFact, yeah. So, Scott Walker and Tony Evers kind of got into a shouting match over Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not necessarily over Twitter, but Tony Evers was like, Scott Walker has taken billions of dollars away from our children. And then PolitiFact kind of went on a very, very cherry-picked look at the facts surrounding it and found it to be mostly false.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about that they only briefly mention in like one of the last paragraphs of their piece on the, on that particular claim is that there were also property tax freezes that are strangling schools all around the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, they were like, well, it doesn't actually add up to $1 billion. Like the current deficit now from like 2010, when he took office, we were still spending like over $170 million less than we were then.
Mm-hmm.
And at points, it has been more than $1 billion less. But combined with the property tax freezes that I'm sure even in the last year would amount to more than $1 billion that's been taken out of the hands of teachers and school administrators who are trying to educate and prepare our future generations.
Yeah.
And I really got to say, Tony Evers' messaging has been terrible.
How so?
He doesn't hit on any, like, I don't know if you follow his Twitter, but...
A little bit. A little less since he got famous. He actually follows me. At least he used to.
But not me.
What? He was one of the first people to follow me on Twitter.
Weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Anyways. Let's see. I guess I'll keep burning through my followers by doing the podcast. But, yeah, Tony Evers' messages aren't pointed enough, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't... maybe come up with specific policy proposals and then lecture about those, like the educator that you are, rather than trying to... I don't know. He's trying to hit, like, demographics. You know what I mean? Like, it's really calculated and mincing words in his proclamations and his statements.
Mm-hmm.
Like, trying to be super-duper careful when, you know, it's way past time to be careful, man. We're in a dead heat, and we'll say the deck isn't exactly stacked in your favor, man. Give people a reason to come vote for you.
Yeah, he... I mean, I hope the guy wins, because I really don't want Walker to win. And I think in terms of... Like, I think in terms of management of the government and his... Like, he does actually seem like someone that would listen to pressure from the left. Yeah, I hope probably. I'm not going to be way wrong on this, where it's like he gets into office and then he like pulls a Bill Clinton and only listens to the center and right. He seems like he would listen to the left. And I think that's important and good. But he is not... If he wins and is like has decent approval ratings throughout his governorship, like it'll be shocking because he's... a counterintuitive government, because like Wisconsin is like this heated, rhetorically sharp, like crazy people on all sides, like political, like warscape, right. And then there's like this kind of like he just sort of seems like a nice dude. He doesn't really have that much to say. He doesn't even seem that thoughtful, and he just like rises above it as everyone beats them. Each other up. I don't know. I'm skeptical it'll work.
I am. That's again what I'm skeptical of. Yeah, he's just not fighting, and that's kind of what people need.
Okay. If he loses, well, a lot of bad shit. But ignoring all that for a second.
Okay.
Like, there has to be a real discussion about. Style and identity in 4 years when we try again. Because him, whatever her name was and whatever his name was.
And Tom Barrett.
Yeah.
Why did they run Tom Barrett twice? Jesus Christ. Yeah,
whatever he was twice. It doesn't work. Because like the logic behind people, at least the people who are open to the further left candidates, voting for Evers... was that, you know, like, he can win northern rural counties and all that, right?
Uh-huh.
But if he doesn't win...
then we need to stop compromising, right?
I mean, hey, maybe not across the board, but, like, in this race, in this state, you have to try something different.
Let's go with Malin Mitchell or Kelda Royce next time.
Well, I'll say this. Those two should be staying involved. Should be maybe running for other offices. They should find something prominent policy-wise, election-wise, something. Because they got their name out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really been one of the things that kind of has gotten me to respect Walker politically. Obviously not in any other way. But it's this idea, I saw it put out there, that he, like, runs for office... knowing he'll lose, just to build those networks. And you even saw him do it for the presidency. He he did. I mean, maybe he thought he'd win, I think the fact that he stepped out so fast, though.
Did you see his statement the other day where he was like, oh, I could have gone and gotten a cabinet position.
Oh, God, I know.
Like, there's no way Trump would have ever had you in his cabinet. I mean,
how do these people vote for Walker? He is such a doof. He's like, who talks that way about that? Something like that? You don't just be like, yeah, I could have been Secretary of State.
But like, I choose to be here serving Wisconsin.
Sounds like a goddamn 11-year-old.
Right?
Like, the audacity of a comment like that. Like, no, you don't...
You don't say that about a cabinet position in the United States federal government. Like, that you could have just had it if you wanted to. Now, maybe, there were, you know, because, like, Trump, like, interviewed as many people as he could for, like, photo ops. So maybe he was invited for, like, an interview for one of the positions. But, like, what job would he have had? Like, what do you think of his Walker's...
I mean, they already handed out the weaker ones, right?
Like, he wasn't going to be... Yeah, he wasn't going to be Secretary of, you know, Defense, State. He doesn't know shit about any of that.
Secretary of the Interior? No.
That might be the one. Affairs? No,
Secretary of Agriculture would probably be a good one, too.
I don't think of him as actually... I don't know. What does the Secretary of Agriculture do? I guess on some level, Walker has, like... He has made a point of building trade relations... relationships with... I mean, shit, he's at this Japan thing right now, right? With, like, other countries to sell Wisconsin products. But I don't know that he's, like, somehow instituted programs that helped us have better or more products to sell.
No.
Not that I know of, at least.
But he would... I mean, he's been eager to implement those work restrictions and everything else around...
Secretary of Labor?
Well, no, the SNAP program and the welfare programs.
And
he would have been able to adjudicate that a little bit more closely. Housing and urban development? Maybe.
So maybe we're not on the darkest timeline.
I mean, these people who are doing those jobs are somehow less competent than Scott Walker.
Mm. All right, let's finish up on this. Here's what I wrote in the notes. This bullshit Right Wisconsin blog post about Milwaukee Vincent. So there is a blog that I guess was at least managed or edited by
Charlie
Sykes for a while. I don't know if he founded it, though. But anyway,
he did.
He left it last year to do what he's doing, hang out with cosmopolitan city folk.
Yeah, he went all moderate and tried to join the resistance after being all right guy.
He's a prominent... I mean, hey, he did write a whole book about, what is it called, like, how the right lost its mind? I mean, he's not mincing words.
Fair.
But that doesn't mean, you know, that you or I agree with any, like, policy things he believes.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that he disagrees with the racist asshole that he left to run Right Wisconsin.
Yeah, I would be interested to know more about that. Because that's the one thing where I've noticed some of the Never Trumpers have been, like, creeping towards understanding how... Because it's kind of like the onus is always on the left to, like... Or at least seems like it. You have to understand what these racist white people, why they think this. Like, they don't think it's racist. I'm like, okay, but...
Because they're stupid. Or they're bigoted. Or whatever reason you want. It doesn't matter.
It was in response to something our legal editor posted the other day. But I was like, all I read from this is... I didn't vote for the racist candidate because he's racist. It's because of economic anxieties or whatever. But anyway, Charlie Sykes, I have noticed change, in the couple times I've seen him in interviews, there's a better understanding of the value of diversity, the humanity of minorities, you know, like things that you or I might take for granted in how we, you know, talk to each other and about other
people.
Yeah. That so many people on the right, like, it's like if you like try to get them to just be like choose their words carefully and things like that, they just get offended and they view it as like some sort of culture war and you're trying to kill them or something. It's just like insane. Anyway, so this. He leaves, and this thing is taken over by his former kind of deputy, who is named, I have it right, James Wigderson. He used to work at some Waukesha paper. I was reading a little bit about him from Urban Milwaukee. I read an article from Urban Milwaukee about Right Wisconsin, just to get like, hey, what do their other, like, their ideological local opposite think? And they actually said that the guy, like, the writer of that article said, like, I kind of like that. I kind of like Jim. Like, he's a nice guy. But he's kind of a fucking lunatic when he comes to this blog post, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's like basement racist or basement dwelling racist kind of stuff.
Yeah, so the basic subject, the key facts of this are that Milwaukee Vincent through, well, Milwaukee Public Schools, I guess, built a, well, multi-million dollar athletic complex. And I guess it's at Milwaukee Vincent. Now, this guy went to Milwaukee Vincent, but back, like, when it opened. And he just shits on it left and right. He shits on
everything that's in his way. Like,
just, like, how it currently is.
Like, it implies that it was not a functional school even when he was there, and he got through despite.
Yes, because he stopped taking gym class. And I thought when I read this, I was like, dude, I bet he's super fat. Mm. and I was like, no, that's a mean thought, Peter. Like, that's not what you should be thinking. And then I was reading the other article about him, and dude is super fat. I'm sorry, but sometimes your immoral thoughts are true.
We usually don't go for the ad hominem attacks here and tell me what you think, but
I can say it as someone who's fat. Although I think he's fatter than me because I took gym class one more year than him. no, I mean, I don't really feel bad. Like, the guy is like, he has no interest in making, like, you can tell from the tone of this article that he has no interest in students being educated.
No. No, he doesn't care.
Like, Milwaukee students being, you know, kids in Milwaukee being educated. It's not, it doesn't fucking matter. And I guess if he's living in Waukesha, now I know why. People in Waukesha don't seem to give a shit about Milwaukee. Never have. Except they just benefit from it.
Yeah. Well, you know, they work there. They drive all their money from the huge corporations that are somewhat still based there and then drive home into the suburbs. And then point their fingers and scoff at the news coverage of all the terrible happenings in the city that they don't provide taxes to.
Did you see the Milwaukee Public School response?
I momentarily just had it up.
Let's see if I can. It starts, I think it's, I don't think it starts. But anyways, in it, I think this is the main subject matter of it, is MPS is outraged. This is a quote. As every parent in the city of Milwaukee should be, that an adult would feel free to make such a derogatory, hurtful, and dishonest statement about more than 75,000 children. And good for them.
Yeah.
Like, their communications guy, that's, he should be working for Tony Evers.
Seriously. The author of the article should be ashamed that he is engaging in such offensive cyberbullying, which we are sure he would not tolerate if his children were being discussed in these abusive terms. Right on, Denise Calloway.
Yep, yep. All right. How were you saying affect the gubernatorial election? What did you mean about that?
Well, you know, we've got right Wisconsin. I mean, I guess no controversy is going to stick to that guy among his supporters, but we've got the flying thing. We've got Scott Walker is just on the offensive, like trying to cram his, or throw as many rounds down range as he can before the fighting is over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, well, I mean, how does it stand?
Yeah.
Notionally, it's a dead heat. So, if you had to predict today, what's your over under on Tony Evers?
Oh man, I'm bad at this type of thing. I'm bad when I have if you ask me to predict who will win, like, I mean, I have to know a little bit first, but like, you know, governor of fucking Missouri or something. Yeah. Or like, yeah, Ted Cruz and Beto or something.
Tony Evers, what's his percentage on election day?
Well, I don't know what will win because I don't know what the third. But I don't know. If I had to guess the difference and who will have the majority, there's something in the back of my head that I can't, despite trying to be cynical about as much as I can. Like, I'm making a conscious effort to be cynical about November and this blue wave, as they call it. But there's something in the back of my head that thinks it makes too much sense to not happen. And if there is a widespread blue wave, it would definitely be seen in a state like Wisconsin. And given that the polling that's out now, granted, one of the polls I saw was a, quote, liberal poll, which I don't know why polls have dishonesty, but they do.
Sure.
And that was a dead heat one, and, like, Evers was, like, tweeting it out. I'm like, dude, that's not that good for you. Like, a biased poll means you're probably down if it says it, you're at a dead heat. But despite that, I think he wins by under 2 points.
I was going to say 3, but, yeah, it's not going to be an easier, clean fight.
No, and that's... And that's being said, like, I am barely going out on that limb. Because there is still a large portion of my predictive capabilities that are thinking, of course it's going to be Walker. Why wouldn't it be?
It probably will be.
But I find that sometimes it's the hunch that once I've, like, taken in all the information and, like, processed it, like, internally for a while, then it turns into a hunch. And I cannot shake this hunch that there is actually going to be a legitimate blue wave. Now, the only thing I'm wondering is that because, I mean, I hate, you know, like, claims of there being a liberal media and all that, but is that because the media, like, is, like, it's propping up these Democrat blue wave stories? They don't seem to be as hyperbolic as they were, like, 6 months ago, but, like, I keep seeing them.
Yeah. But maybe it's just hopeful journalism.
Yeah.
This is the year of the woman. We've had several women who have basically won their primaries, and, like, some unopposed are just walking into Congress because of it, so that's kind of cool.
I think the different makeup of the candidates, 538 did a analysis of the candidates and kind of looking at, like how they've been fared and then their, different aspects of identity, but gender was, like, the one where it's like, no, actually female candidates are doing better this year than ever before. Like, by a lot.
That hopefully means more women are voting.
And that all else being equal, being a woman gives you an advantage, at least so far in the primaries this year.
Sorry, Kathy Myers.
and that, yes, that should hopefully bring out more women voters. Which, I mean, if that happens in a midterm, it has all the makings, especially if it happens if those are women in, you know, suburbs, affluent communities that would normally go red. It has all the makings of it, and, you know, all these polls are close, and they're close with the underdog Democrats, you know, like Beto down in Texas, like even Evers. Like, I would say Evers is the underdog still. I mean, yeah, he's going against the three-time champ, right? It makes every time I bring up that Scott Walker has won an election, you get audibly upset. Sorry. It's like, yeah, I can't just say Scott Walker has once won an election without you groaning.
God damn it.
All right. All right. Well, this has been Tell Me What to Think. This has been Closing Thoughts. You can find all of our old podcasts and this one at which you already would be listening to, so you don't need to go to it for this episode, unless you want to listen to it a second time. www.stoneduckmedia.com. Find me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. Charles is at green_weird, which is WYRD. You can email the pod at tmwttpod@gmail.com. Facebook, Tell Me What to Think page. Give it a like. Share us and share rate and review and all that on Apple, Stitcher, Google Play. I don't think there's any reviewing on Google Play.
Hey, ask us if you see any mistakes.
Yeah. If you see any mistakes, if you hear any mistakes,
our voice,
if you have any requests, if you want to be on the show, I think this fall we'll have a couple guests. I think we've already been talking.
Yeah, I think some next week we could probably have a couple
returning guests. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So you have a good night, Charles.
You too. Stay safe, everybody.
All right.
Days of sunny, days of rain. Destroy the myths that will break our chains. Break your chains!